Pirate's Pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Welcome to the Jeff Poor Show, this Monday edition. So good to be with you. 6 minutes after the hour. Big show planned for you today. Coming up in the next segment, we're going to hear from Congressman Gary Palmer, Alabama's 6th Congressional District. Trump's executive actions over the weekend, dealing with the coronavirus downturn. A lot of the other things going on in politics right now. What do the chances for the House, the Republicans getting the House back, look like? We're going to talk to Representative Palmer about that and more, so make sure you stay tuned for that. Also got Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill coming on with us. Mail-in voting seems to be still in the news. This close to the election, there's a subset of Democrats. Well, I say a subset. It's pretty much the entire Democratic Party that think you could do mail-in voting just at the last moment here, just days, weeks before an election, and everything go okay. But we've seen that's not the case. What I want to talk to Secretary Merrill about, I think, you know, what if they told him you have to do mail-in voting tomorrow? And that's essentially different from what we have now. We kind of have mail-in voting light, where you can apply for an absentee ballot and then you can fill out your ballot and you get it either notarized or a witness to sign it and then mail it in and it counts. But whatever, the way mail-in voting would work in the sense of what Democrats want, they would just go to the voter logs, find all the addresses, and mail everybody their ballot like it's the census or something of that sort. We'll talk about census a little bit later. Kind of some interesting numbers there. Also, from WVNN, Dale Jackson will be with us. Will Dismukes, college football. We'll discuss that with Dale. You could hear him on the weekends here, Alabama Politics this week. But we're going to try to make him a little, maybe a regular feature on the program. And then, speaking of regular features, we will hear from State Representative Matt Simpson in studio. He joins us in the 11 a.m. hour, so make sure that you stay tuned for that. It sounds like college football season may not happen. That is driving a lot of discussion in this area. I know it is. I got to tell you, though, it just seems like if they cancel football, is that going to get Joe Biden elected? I mean, not that we're thinking that way, or any some of these college presidents may be thinking that way, because academia is left wing by nature. But let's say outside of that, the way this will be tackled by the media is like they want to build this misery in the public, and every little thing, every little, you know, there was a push to cancel sports. Where did that come from? Was that out of concern? You know, maybe, but I think there is an element of this. I think there's an element of the more we can check a lot of boxes and make people feel bad about things, build up, what is it, the misery index? That's going to get Joe Biden elected. That's not everybody. I'm not ascribing motives to everybody, but there are people like that. There's no question about it. And you could just see, watch this. You know, a lot of you that keep up with sports and don't really turn on cable, the moment this announcement is made, tune in to CNN and see if it's announced with glee. So just look for little cues. You know, like, compare that to the day after Trump's elected to when college football is canceled. Just notice the emotional difference. That's Trump getting elected may be the extreme, but this is an extreme for a lot of people as well. Watch that. I think there's something to that. I think that's where the push came from, and it's made it, given this more of a sense of urgency. Because, wow, I understand there are other reasons, the health concerns, the liability concerns, but don't discount the public relations concern. Don't discount the public relations concern when it deals with these colleges, because the one thing I learned from my years at academia, well, at least at the University of South Alabama, is these colleges, they're very concerned about their image. They're concerned about their image because of the money they may get from the federal and state governments. They're concerned about the image because they want students to go there. They want everything to be on the up and up. They don't want to take a PR hit. The people that would land that PR hit on these colleges, on these institutions of higher learning, they're the ones that are in the media. And if the media say, we don't need to have college football, it's just too dangerous, too risky, there's just too much going on there, let's err on the side of caution. That may have some sway. I think, in fact, it does have some sway. One thing I would say, though, let's compare the Spanish flu pandemic. You know what they did during the Spanish flu pandemic? They played college football. You could go back and look. So there's precedent here. And you could go back and look at these old photographs, and they're wearing masks up in the stands. They did this. There's a way to do this if they really, really wanted to. But we're in such a litigious society now. I mean, it's so much different than it was in 1916. You don't have that element. And as I said earlier, you don't have the media just playing kind of a political interference here. There's a lot of motivations here based on politics. There's no question about that. We may get into that a little more later in the program, so make sure you stay tuned. We're going to take a quick timeout. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Song of the South. Sweet potato pie and I shut my mouth. Gone with the wind. There ain't nobody looking back again. Cotton on the roadside, cotton in the ditch. We all picked the cotton, but we never got rich.
A few gray feather olives sailed. Could have had him any day. We only let him go so long. Out of kindness, I suppose.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poore Show on FM Talk 106.5. 251-343-0106. That's 251-343-0106. President signed an executive order over the weekend. What do you need to know about this? There's some things in there. Questionable, constitutional, maybe not. But the thing you need to know about that, will the Democrats muster up the courage? Will Nancy Pelosi try to pull a John Boehner? Remember John Boehner saying Obamacare was unconstitutional? What did he do? Did he defund it? No. We're going to file a lawsuit. Did anybody check on that lawsuit lately? Anyway, that lawsuit was going to be the greatest thing ever. I haven't heard much about it in the last 10 years or so, but could Nancy Pelosi do the same thing to Donald Trump with this executive order? Do Democrats really want to stand in the way of what was a payroll tax holiday? Here's how it's going to work, guys. Donald Trump is the head of the executive branch. He could tell the IRS, hey, stop collecting these taxes. Defer them. Stop collecting them. And then you put the pressure on Congress to forgive them. It works kind of like that. Now, who knows what could happen after the 2020 election. But the idea is no payroll tax. It's like a 7% raise for people earning under $100,000. Student loan deferment. The way they do some of this with the unemployment, they're extending unemployment benefits, but the CARES Act left some money there that the president had discretion over. But it's going to, you know, obviously with a lot of things the federal government does, there's going to be a state matching component to it because the state handles these unemployment claims. And the Fed matches that money, and it's like 3-1 or so. I don't know what the formula is, but that is the other way they're handling this to kind of get around Congress. So, because right now Congress is at a standstill, there is no hope that Congress will do anything to that's going to be able to get a bill passed. Look, it is right before an election. Congress traditionally has not passed things like this at the last moment, and there's several exceptions, obviously. The biggest one, probably that a lot of us remember in recent history, is TARP, the bailout, as the economy was quote-unquote crashing, but mostly just the markets falling. The Congress came together and passed an emergency bailout with Pelosi. Remember that? The very end of George W. Bush's presidency. And Bill, I mean, that was probably the beginning of the end for John McCain right there. He did not handle it well. He wasn't well versed on issues of the economy. He looked like he was caught flat-footed. But other than that, you don't really see these big cornerstone, you know, where somebody might think that somebody's getting a political advantage over the other. You don't see things like that happen in the Congress unless it's just, holy cow, we have an emergency. We got to get this done. We got to get around this right now. And I think we passed that moment. I think that was that first CARES Act where, okay, we got $3 trillion out the door. Now everybody's got their own idea about, well, this, I'd like this issue tackled, I'd like this issue tackled, I'd like this issue tackled. And all of that accumulates. And then it just leads to a situation where there's no progress made, that you're in this stalemate. And that's where we are. You get Trump's executive action. It stands right now as the way it looks to me, but it may take a little time to work its way through. And then will somebody challenge it? Don't underestimate the ability of the courts, particularly some of these Obama or Clinton appointed judges, to figure out a way to try to stall this. But it would be politically unwise, I think, for Democrats in Congress to try to challenge it. Let's take a quick phone call. Let's talk to JD. JD from Mobile, what's on your mind?
I had a question. I was wondering why, when the, I'm thinking maybe you can answer it for me. I've thought about it. I just can't figure it out. But why, I believe it was Obama was in the White House at the time, but the Democrats were in charge of the Senate, I guess. But the Republicans had majority in the House. So the Republicans would stand up a little bit, and they'd wring their hands, and they'd say, well, we've done all we can do. We're just going to have to go along with them. But now, the Republicans are in charge of the White House and the Senate, and everything's got to go through Nancy Pelosi. They're the majority in the House, but that's the extent of it. So why, you know, the Republicans don't have a backbone or what? You know, I'm just wondering why, in the past, the Republicans give it up and say, well, we've done all we can do. And now, like I say, the Democrats draw a hard line. And if you don't like it, you know, I hate it for you. But the Democrats, everything now has got to go through Nancy Pelosi. I'm just wondering why.
Well, I think there's something to what you said, J.D., and thank you for the call. What I would say, I think there is, this is not really what Republicans do. They don't get in. They already know what they want to do with their position in Congress traditionally, and it's almost like Democrats are roaming the earth looking for crises to respond to, and this is one of them. So you know, you look at the Republicans, they have an agenda, they want to get X, Y, and Z done. Where Democrats, they want to tell you this has got to be addressed, this has got to be addressed, this has got to be addressed. There's a certain mindset about the two parties. It's fascinating to talk about. No, but to your broader point, yeah, clearly Republicans don't have the backbone. They don't have the media on their side. The Republicans are very, very conscious of public relations. We've never seen Democrats on the ropes of just getting hammered in the media. We haven't seen that since probably, what, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky? I mean, that's been over two decades ago. I mean, you think of when have you seen Democrats in power just really getting hammered by the mainstream media? It doesn't happen that much. And if it does, it's a little blip on the radar, then we move on. But it's been a long time since we've seen that. So they have that advantage. And that's why I think Democrats are on the offensive. Republicans always look like they're playing defense. And that's the problem. And you raise a good point, JD, but that's a problem. Something popping up on the news here. It looks like there's a major explosion reported in Baltimore with adults and children trapped. That's according to Fox Baltimore. Let me read you the news here. A major explosion occurred near Ristertown Road on Monday morning, according to reports. Baltimore City Firefighters Union tweeted that several houses exploded and at least five people trapped along with some children. Looks like it's a little further out of Baltimore not quite near the downtown, but this could be a big news story as things unfold throughout the day. I'll just give you a heads up on that. Doug Jones on Friday, Alabama Public Television, Capital Journal. This is a remarkable stuff. Not really, you wouldn't expect him to really be too worried about that 17-point Morning Consult poll margin he has trailing Tommy Tuberville in the November election, and he kind of just missed that poll, and I would fully expect that. But he said some things. Well, that was loud there. he said some things that were interesting, that Tuberville hasn't really been tested yet, and took a shot at Jeff Sessions for not really testing him. So one would have to believe Doug Jones is going to confront him at some point, or I would think his campaign is. Very, very aggressive language there for Doug Jones. He's going to have to be. This is going to be, it's going to make some of us cringe. I think some of the things we're going to revisit, the whole hedge fund thing, we're going to revisit any player that wants to step forward. They play for Tommy Tuberville. Keep in mind, Ole Miss, Auburn University, Cincinnati, Texas Tech, even some stints as an assistant coach down at Miami. There's got to be perhaps thousands of players that played at some point under Tommy Tuberville as a football coach. So you know somebody's going to speak out, and that's going to be a surprise. The way it looks to me, Doug Jones is that this is the nature of campaigns now, but if he wants, he has any prayer, and I still think it's a very long shot. And I think 17 points is probably an accurate reflection. But he's going to have to throw everything in the kitchen sink at it. And it's going to, you know the way this is going to work, guys. These allegations will get thrown out. And while it won't be as front and center as Roy Moore versus Doug Jones of 2017, I promise you it'll get some national headlines. It'll be New York Times, Washington Post, CNN material, MSNBC, Rachel Maddow. I mean, do a segment on it, you know, and point to this football coach and then just play all the stereotypes. I mean, we're talking about college football season being canceled. There's already a suspicion from people in that world about organized sports, particularly on a college level, that toxic masculinity, you ever hear that? It's things like that that are going to, I think, come up in this Senate campaign. Doug Jones talking a very big game right now, and got the money to back it. Still got a tough road to hoe. I still will tell you this, at the end of the day, there may be a few points difference, but that is going to track much like the Biden-Trump matchup here in Alabama. It's not tracking that right now. If you had to say today at the election, Trump probably beats Biden by 30 points or so, which is a lot more than 17 points, I still think that margin widens. And the more and more we get there as we head that way, the margin between Tuberville and Jones is going to weigh. What Tuberville's going to hit Jones with, I think, you'll watch these. It'll be the abortion issue. That always comes up. That's a big hot button in Alabama. But also you want to watch for, the vote on Kavanaugh impeachment and just a general support for Donald Trump. I'm going to get up there. I'm going to help Donald Trump. That's why you need to vote for me. Make sure that you vote for me. Also, in this era of law and order, as we see downtowns burn, police precincts burn, I think you're going to see a real push about Doug Jones being weak on law and order. That seems to be a direction of things. That is going to be the hot button. We don't want that coming to Alabama. We don't want that kind of environment here. We like our law and order. We want our police back to blue. We're not going to defund the police. None of that's going to play here in Alabama. Well, by the end of this, they will make Doug Jones into be the anti-police guy. That is certain to be a part of that. I feel like that's already been teased. If you watched, the one thing you could watch with that is what Tommy Tuberville said on the night of his election win back in July 14th. And he really laid it out. And I say this over and over again, but I think you're going to see a real the way he does it, it's very compelling. It is, we're talking about college football, takes that locker room talk, marries it with the red meat issues, and people eat it up. If he could do more of that, that margin is going to widen more than 17 points. Jones could come in and talk about the kitchen table issues and everybody's like that, but he's got a voting record. It's going to be tough to explain. So, we'll get more into all of that, hear from you. Join us next segment. Hopefully, we'll have Congressman Gary Palmer, so stay tuned. This is the Jeff Porch Show at FM Talk 106.5.
Ooh, Montgomery.
Right up over Spanish Fort into Mobile, my hometown. Mr. T. Open up a big old can. Good times, unwind, falling and out of love in the same night.
Welcome back to the Jeff Porch Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you on this Monday. I've made it to my second week here. I haven't been terminated. That's a good sign, I think, just for life in general. So to come on the program today, we're here from Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill, my old colleague from WVNN up in Huntsville, Dale Jackson, and in the third hour, we will hear from State Representative Matt Simpson, who will join us in studio. Some things to talk about here just popping up on my screen. So make sure that you stay tuned. That'll be a great show. But joining us on the line, always a pleasure to introduce this next guest. He represents the 6th Congressional District. That's the area around Birmingham. Congressman Gary Palmer is on the line. Congressman, how are you today?
Good morning, Jeff, and congratulations on your move.
Hey, thank you very much. Very kind words. Let's get right into it. Tell us, I'm curious to see what you have to say about Trump's executive action over the weekend. It seems like it's treading into some constitutional dubious territory there, but what's your feeling on that?
Well, from a political perspective, it was a brilliant strategic move because it really puts Pelosi and Schumer over a barrel. Where they need to be, by the way, because they have not been bargaining in good faith. But from a constitutional perspective, I do think it violates Article 1 of the Constitution, violates the separation of powers. What's interesting, though, Jeff, is how this how Pelosi and Schumer are going to have to deal with this in the context of what Obama did using executive orders. So when he did it, they were fine with it.
Right. And even early on with the Trump executive orders, there was always somebody out there willing to go judge shopping and find a Obama or Clinton appointed judge to rule against this. But I guess the appetite, the question is, will the Democratic Party be willing to do that when there seems to be a handful of giveaways involved with this executive order?
Well, absolutely they'll do it. They were doing it on legitimate executive orders, things that were totally within his authority. There'll be a judge that will challenge this immediately, but it really puts Pelosi and Schumer, again, like I said, over a barrel because it brings into greater focus how they were just really trying to push a political agenda. They wanted $3.4 trillion. They wanted to bail out California and Illinois and some other states' pension plans. California and Illinois' unfunded liability, those two states, just those two, is $1 trillion. And she has forgotten her role. I think she's been acting unconstitutionally in some of the things that she being Pelosi, has been doing.
Well, she's out front a lot more than it seems lately than she normally would be. Is it just a product of the election cycle, or is she really trying to? I mean, she seems more of the head of the Democratic Party these days than Joe Biden, the Democratic presidential nominee. Is she really trying to push this agenda, thinking that, I don't know, any of this HEROES Act or any of that, really she could win in court public opinion and get it done that way?
Well, she is being consistent in her philosophy of how to do this. If you go back and look at the 2009 Obama-Biden stimulus, it was $831 billion. They were talking about how that stimulus package would grow the economy at 4% per year by 2012. They were saying that it would create 250 to 500,000 jobs per month, and that it would add thousands of dollars to household income. What happened to that bill is the same thing that's happening to this bill. Is Pelosi loaded it up with pension bailout? She took the work requirements off of food stamps, expanded unemployment, and it resulted in the economy growing at 1.5%. We still had 9% unemployment, and household income went down by thousands of dollars. She's doing the same thing again, Jeff. There was a University of Chicago economist that looked at the 2009 stimulus package and talked about what Pelosi did, and he called it the redistribution recession.
Is that, there does seem to be that you know, the you do these big landmark type of things like the Heroes Act, you put $3 trillion in the economy, and perhaps this could be, it's just the economics of it, you have that $600 a week incentive not to go back to work, that might make employers try to pay more. It's kind of like a backdoor approach to raising the minimum wage or raising wages, it seems, a little bit.
Well, that same University of Chicago economist looked at the 2009 package and then what Pelosi did, and he determined that between 2 and 3 million people were earning, by not working, were earning 80 to 100% of what they had been earning when they did work. And he sarcastically commented that most economists agree if you pay people not to work, they don't work. If you look at the $600 per week that the federal government was adding to the state unemployment benefit, in Alabama, that was $21.87 an hour. There were 12 states where if you had dependents, they gave you additional unemployment benefits. And in Massachusetts, the average hourly rate for not working was $45.50 per hour. That's $94,000 a year. So that will crush economic recovery. And that's what she's trying to do. Plus, when you said $3 trillion to stimulate the economy, when you're putting trillions of dollars of that into bailing out pensions, that money's not going into the economy. That suppresses economic growth.
What is the right approach here? I actually don't think I get the ideological component. The government involved in the economy, never really a good thing. But if you had to go look for federal government stimulus, what do you think is the most effective approach?
Well, I think for one thing, we look at additional tax cuts and the payroll tax, removing that for the rest of the year. That puts money into the consumers' pockets. I think you increase the dependent exemptions and credits for families with kids. I think that we have to incentivize businesses, particularly moving the supply chain back to the United States with tax incentives. Those are the kind of things that I think that matter. I think we've got to get a vaccine. That will be huge for getting the economy going again. And we got to address some of the issues related to certain industries, like the restaurant industry, that there's no way they can operate at 50% capacity and stay in business. So there are a number of things that I think can be done that can help us get back on the right track. And keep in mind, Jeff, that they were projecting unemployment rates of up, 20%. We're at 11.3% right now. Alabama's below 8%. And if we weren't paying people not to work, I think it'd be even lower. I think people want to go back to work. And if we can make it safe for them to go back, and allow the businesses to get going again, we'll see the economy grow again.
When we talk about repatriating some of these businesses and getting this supply chain back here, is there a federal government response? Is there a price tag you could put on that? I mean, now we're throwing around trillions of dollars. What what do you think it would take to, I mean, to get some of this back in the states?
Well, I don't think you do it overnight all at once, and you don't necessarily bring it all back to the states, but you want to get it out of countries that are hostile to you. This is not just an economic issue, it's a national security issue. And when you talk about your drug supply chain being 70-80% reliant on one country, in this case China, that's a huge problem. When you're talking about things like rare earth metals and other components that we have to have for everything from making your cell phone work to some of our military equipment, that's a problem. So it's not a short term fix, but there are things that we can do that I think that will help business bring that supply chain, at least if not back to the United States, back to countries that are not hostile.
Because you look at that trend there, initially coming out of this, when we first went into lockdown, there's a lot of discussion about getting that supply chain back. It seems like it's been put on the back burner. Is that would be something to me that you look at the politics of it, it would be a winner for either Democrats or Republicans. But it doesn't seem to. It seems like it's kind of an afterthought at this time.
No, it's not an afterthought with us. I chair the policy committee. We've spent hours on this. The Republicans have a special task force just dealing with China that's chaired by Mike McCall, who's the ranking member on the Foreign Affairs Committee. This is a top priority for us. But because we're in the minority, we have no chance of moving anything forward. The Democrats have no interest in anything other than one thing, and that is to defeat Donald Trump. They're obsessed with it.
Well, let's talk about that election coming up here in a matter of months. What's your crystal ball tell you? What's your outlook? You know, there was some hope before all of this pandemic that there was some hope that the House was in reach. Do you still feel that way today?
Yeah, I think the House is in reach. If the election were tomorrow, we would need to win 17 seats to get the majority back. But because of redistricting in North Carolina, we're going to lose two seats there. So we need 19. But there are 54 Democrat seats in play. 30 of them are in districts that the president won in 16. And 43 of them have better metrics than that special election we won in California back in May with Mike Garcia, our candidate. Won that by more than 10 points in a district that Hillary had won by 7 points and that the Democrat who had held that seat had won by 9 or 10. So I think the American people are smarter about what's going on than the Democrats give them credit for, and they see what happened last night in Chicago, what's happening in Portland, Seattle, and these other places. I don't think they want to hand the government over to people like that. So I think. And last week, Rasmussen poll showed the president's approval rating was back up to 51%. So, and one other point on this, Jeff, is the Cato Institute put out a report back in 16 that showed that 58% of the people were reluctant to talk about their positions on the presidential race or politics. They did that report again about a month or so ago, and it showed that that's actually 62% now. And I can guarantee you, if they were talking to Democrats don't have a problem telling you what their positions are.
Well, it always seems like Democrats underperform when people actually go to vote, that they don't have the numbers. But we're told it's smooth sailing all the way to November. Biden has this. I think that is not necessarily accurate. But do you think Trump on the ballot, that seems to be a coattail phenomenon, and that may be more promising than what had happened with the 2018 midterms.
Well, here's what I tell your listeners to take note of. Here's Jill Biden living in the same house with Joe Biden, who's out doing interviews, who's out in meetings, and she's in her 60s, I believe. She's not as old as Joe, but I think she's in her 60s, in that age group that is considered at risk. But she's able to go out and meet with people. She's able to do interviews face-to-face. But Joe can't. So people ought to be asking themselves a question. Why is it that he can send his wife out, but he can't go out?
Do you have a theory on that?
Well, there are a number of people who have theories on that. Not the least of which is that he's a gaffe machine.
Yeah, and he's always been kind of this gaffe machine, it seems. And the cycle's no exception to that. So I guess if you're a Republican, that kind of gives you at least some hope that he can't make it to November 3rd without really muddying things up.
If they let him out, I'm not sure he could make it to the end of the week. My first contact with Joe Biden was the very first work that I did in D.C. when I ran the think tank, and that was Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearing. And you may recall that he'd gone through controversy then. He, as you said, Jeff, it's well known that he's surrounded in controversy, and like I said, he's a gaffe machine.
Well, and I think that those who watch these things in the media aren't really... They're not taking that into account. They're not making that big enough factor when they say that Biden's got this on November 4th. Congressman, we're up against a break here, but thanks for making time for us. We've got to do it again real soon.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jeff. And again, congratulations on your new gig down on the Gulf Coast.
Thank you very much. I really, really appreciate that. That was Congressman Gary Palmer of Alabama's 6th Congressional District. We got to get out of here, get to a break. We will return. This is FM Talk 106.5.
Jack Daniel's whiskey at 1.5 is how the folks around here have been living their lives. Waking and baking every morning at 8, make it to work, they're always late. Living by the job, paying their dues. Life in Dixie with these Alabama blues.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. So good to be with you. Coming up in the next segment, you want to stay tuned for Alabama Secretary of State John Merrill. How are things going on around the state? Every state has a little different situation with COVID-19, with coronavirus. But we go to vote, and we got a sample of it on July 14th. But that is, the election on November 3rd and July 14th are going to be very, very different. You have a lot of turnout for a presidential election. You always do. There has to be that, but some of these places, how did they handle it? Also, turnout. What's turnout going to look like? Very, very politicized atmosphere right now. I want to get into that with Secretary Merrill, so stay tuned for that. Some other things going on, just kind of the vice presidential sweepstakes, if you will, the veep stakes, as they call it. We're getting very close to go time for Joe Biden. There, over the weekend, I tell you, Susan Rice's stock has gone up. She's the former national security advisor. She's probably in second place right now, but to me, it's going to be Kamala Harris. I don't see how it isn't. It's the safe play. It checks the box. They want to get checked to a minority female. But I like a lot of buzz about Michelle Obama. I don't think she wants it. Gretchen Whitmer would be my dream pick, though. You talk about a gaffe machine and just somebody's completely unlikable. Put those together on the ticket. I mean, that's a base play right there. There'll be people fired up because you have this big government nanny state type of governor that just oozes with disdain for anything right of center. She would get hammered. She may be very good on the stump. Who knows? She may get that voter turnout, but she would be the dream matchup. Michigan, and also one thing she has going in her favor is Michigan up for grabs. Michigan holding steady. If you look at the polling, it wasn't an anomaly what happened in 2016 with Trump carrying Michigan. Michigan much closer than Pennsylvania or these other states that could flip. Michigan's remaining in that column. They're starting to figure out. I think pollsters are starting to figure this out. They're never going to get the big turnout like they had in 2008, 2012 with Barack Obama. You really had a high record African-American turnout that favored Democrats. It's hard to replicate that. It's going to be very, very hard to replicate that in the future. I think that's the hope with a Kamala Harris on the ticket. But Gretchen Whitmer, please make her your running mate, Joe Biden. Take a break. We'll be right back. This is FN Talk 106.5.
There ain't nobody looking back again.